Thanks, Erica. We really have had an incredibly long experience together. And in fact, one of the first things I worked on with Erica was the other collection of short stories. I've only ever done two collections of short stories. One is called Green Monkey Dreams, which came out years and years ago. And there was an online petition asking for it to be brought back into print. And I just heard a guy in Bendigo was telling me the other day, he was online bidding for a copy, trying to get one. And the bidding went up to $50. And he said, I hate to tell you, I was too poor and I decided not to go on. But he went on the next day to check how much it went for. And it went for $300. And so I was really amazed to hear this. So I don't have anything to do with that petition, but it was really nice to hear. Short stories are not easy to write. I mean, you see the size of some of the books that I've written. It sometimes takes me as long to write a short story as it takes to write a book. They're very, very dense. Some of them in Metro Winds are short stories. Others are novella. Someone was telling me one of the stories, The Wolf Prince in Metro Winds, seems they loved it, but it was too short. And someone else in the same conversation said they loved it, but it was long. And that's because it's a strange form. We're not accustomed to reading novella or novelettes. We're accustomed to reading either short stories or books, but not in between. And there's some lovely other forms. So I would ask, if you do buy this book, to read it with an open mind about the length of stories and let yourself go with the story rather than impose on the story an expectation of whatever. I would like you to impose no expectations when you read these stories. I love the short story form. I love it really better than any other form of writing. And so for me, this is a very special collection. That was a very special collection. And my editor at that time was Erica. Erica was also the editor on The Gathering, which won me Book of the Year. So she's really been very much twined in to the process for me of writing. Also, when I came to her with Metro Winds, it was because I was desperate. I missed her and I wanted to do something that I could do with Erica again. So I had this idea of these four books. I signed the contract 10 years ago, and you'll be surprised it's taken me this long to finish those stories. So I signed this contract, and at the time I really wanted to write, as Erica says, about the stages of a woman's life. And we were looking at like the possibilities of the tarot card. So I was thinking child, princess, queen and crone. And that was my idea. But I wrote some of the stories, but then I began to realize it wasn't enough. Maybe I moved past the stage where I only wanted to write from the point of view of women. There were stories I also wanted to tell that were also mythical, that were fairy tale-ish, that were somehow drawing into the same net that I wanted to write about. So the concept began to reform. And what's great about Erica is that she allowed it. She allowed the process of change to happen. Because, of course, I grow too over the times that I'm writing. So it took me a really long time. I didn't end up writing the crone story. That was the one I stopped on. And for a long time, I was just stopped because I'm not quite yet a crone. And I'm actually waiting for the wisdom that will come. Like, I feel like maybe when I am that age, some great beauty and wisdom will be in that age for me. But I'm not there yet. I actually don't want to go there. So until I'm there and can experience it, I just feel like I'm not ready. So I have a story which is partly written, and it'll probably be another 10 years before I finish it. So the process changed. The book was very malleable all the way through. This is how I write. I've been on stage with people who have maps and charts and histories, and I'm always deeply intimidated if I have to be on stage after somebody like that, because I feel that I lack the proper accreditation if I don't have all these things. My writing is very organic. It is chaotic, and out of chaos comes creativity. It's chaotic to some extent, and a lot of it happens beneath the conscious mind. I don't write a lot of notes. I have most of it in my mind, and I just think about stories or books for a long, long time before I write them. I don't believe in writer's block. I always feel that when I can't go forward with something, I'm lacking an ingredient. I'm not ready. I'm not fermented enough. I need to wait a little bit more time. So that's how I see a stop. And so the stops when I was writing this, I didn't feel worried about it, although I did feel terribly guilty whenever I had to see Erica. Not once in all that process did she make me feel bad. Not once in all that process did she ever threaten to join that website, Hurry Up Isabel Carmody, that exists out there. So it is for me a very special collection because I was able to let it evolve without ever feeling any pressure. And these days I write under a lot of pressure sometimes, and to the point where with the last book that I was writing, I felt there was sometimes just simply too much pressure. But I never felt that with Metro Wind. So for me, it's a fully evolved collection. I saw a man buying it for his 12-year-old daughter. Unless you have an extremely evolved 12-year-old, this is not the book for a 12-year-old. One of the other books is for a 12-year-old. What I hope that this book will be read by all those people who grew up reading me, you know, all the way up. And 16, 17, 18-year-olds, this is a fine book for that age group. But not younger, not little kids. This is not a little children's book. I don't think of age when I write. When I wrote my first book, I was 14. I think most people know that. And I wasn't writing for adolescents. I actually was an adolescent. And to this day, I still write as truthfully as I can from the character that I'm writing about. And I just thought I'd maybe go through the Metro Winds collection and tell you a little story from each one of them. Not the actual story itself, but the stories that went into it. Because when you keep all of the ideas in your head, and for those of you who are writers, I recommend this, rather than writing notes, sometimes it's better to keep it in your head because it's much more fluid. It's much more likely to suck up the world, to be alive and fluid and organic and constantly growing. I think anyone in this room who writes will find that you sit down sometimes, you start with great excitement to write, and then you run out of steam partway through. And that's mostly because the idea isn't evolved enough. You don't have enough material yet. And for me, stories always beget stories. When I was writing the Metro Winds story, this was the princess age of the original concept. And in the Metro Winds story, I should probably explain that I was living in Paris. In fact, I've lived overseas basically for the whole time that I've written this series. And when we were first talking about how to make the series look, how we should put it together, because each story was written in a different city overseas, mostly, there was a suggestion that maybe we would promote the travel side of it. But actually, to me, that wasn't the most important aspect. You know, when you travel, and I don't mean anywhere in particular, I mean you travel outside of your comfort zone. And that can be, you know, to some city you're not familiar with where you don't know the maps. Or it can mean to Hong Kong or into mainland China or to Vietnam or to France or wherever. So you travel to places. When you're home, if you want to do the washing, it's really easy. You just go, you stick it in, you don't have to think about it. But when you go overseas, even a journey to go and put the washing in a laundromat can be a huge quest. You move out of your comfort zone and suddenly you start noticing the world. It's like you strip off a layer of yourself and suddenly you're seeing the world differently. You notice the things people do. You become hyper aware. So for me, the travel was a metaphor for sort of like noticing the world. And that was what I was actually doing physically and in my own life. But what I was looking at in the stories was the way travel is a kind of a metamorphosis of self, the way you change when you write, not externally, but perhaps that too, but internally, emotionally, psychologically, how travel changes you. And by travel, I don't just mean the physical travels, but the journey through life, the journey through time. And so to me, that's what all of these stories are about. And one of the reasons I was drawing that fairy tale sense into them was because, first of all, fairy tales can deal with very dark, deep, potent themes. And that's what I wanted to touch on. And also they deal with that sense of telescoping time. And they have that lovely mythic resonant language. They have that lovely heightened language. I mean, you only have to hear someone say, once upon a time, and something in you starts listening. Suddenly you grow quiet, suddenly you grow attentive. So there's a music and there's a rhythm and there's a cadence to that fairy tale language that I'm really attracted to. And I'm really attracted to that ornate language. I remember that when I was at university writing creatively, a tutor once said to me, Isabel, you have a very purple turn of phrase, which I think meant 16 adjectives to every sentence. And he said, you can't do that. That's not good writing. And I thought he was probably right, but one bit of me yearned for the ornate brocade of all those words. And then I read Angela Carter, and I realized you could use all of those adjectives. You could have this beautiful, rich, ornate, brocaded language. So I was drawn to that. Though you may doubt it looking at the length of my books, I'm also drawn to really spare, beautiful writing, which is probably why Ursula Le Guin is my literary heroine. Spare, beautiful prose, pared right down to nothing, almost no adjectives. So for me, it's being torn between the two, wanting to be pared down, wanting to be clean and cut down, but also at the same time, wanting to enjoy the beauty of language, that poetic richness that you can have. So with Metro Winds, I was staying in Paris in the Keesing studio. Any of you that out there who are writers, you can apply to stay for 6 months in the Keesing studio in Paris. And I was staying there. And I hated it when I first stayed there. It was summer and it was the city. And I'd never lived in a city in my life. And people were jackhammering in the studio next to me. And I just thought, this is horrible. Why did I think this would be a good idea? But then autumn came. And the season changed, it became cooler, and the tourists left and the real people came back again. And one night I was walking over top of the grate that runs over the metro tunnels, and out of the grate came this gust of wind. And I just thought, what is that? And later on I was going down into the metro and the same thing happened. And we don't have them here, but I'm accustomed to it. I'm familiar with it now, but I still remember the magic of that earth breathing out at me, this strange scented air. It didn't smell of earth, but it smelled of something, of things. And I just loved it. I was enchanted with it. I know what it is, of course. It's just a train punching through the tunnels, but the romantic in me thought it was something breathing itself out of the earth. So into the Metro Winds story, I was trying to suck up that. Also, I was very, very homesick. And I'm always homesick for Apollo Bay. I'm always homesick for the sea. And once an editor, not Erica or not Nan, but once an editor told me, Isabel, you just managed to get the sea in every single thing you write, don't you? And that's because I'm homesick. And again, that's that sucking up of life and reality, my life, that goes into even the most far away from reality fantasy. It still should suck up real life. So Metro Winds contains that essence of my longing for Australia when I was away from it, my longing from my home, for the simplicity of the life that I'd once lived, pretty solitarily living by the sea, and also my sort of enchantment with being overseas. And in a way it was very interesting because the stories progress chronologically in age, so the characters become old, each of them are older as the collection works. And so Metro Winds is very much from my first days overseas when I was still very new and very fresh and very intimidated by a lot that was happening there. I felt as light as sunlight because of the history, the weight of history other people carried. And I was living later on in the Czech Republic where I just felt people carry that history so heavily. And so I felt light, but I also felt I felt free of that weight of history, but I also felt insubstantial and slightly insignificant. So Metro Winds and also the Dove Game story are very much out of that time. I just thought, just to give you a little flavour of this story and of the language, I would read you just a little bit from Metro Winds, which is the title story to the collection. It's not the beginning, it's a little way in, just because it's a nice little section to read that isn't too long. The girl gazed around. It was the hottest part of the day, and she could feel the dampness forming in the curve of her upper lip and along her spine, prickling at her palms. Beyond the awning roof of the restaurant, the park shimmered. There were green hedges manicured into animal shapes, but they cast no shade. Carefully edged rose beds surrounded a small marble fountain where a woman with bare stone breasts endlessly poured water from a jug into a bowl. The paths were made from crushed white gravel that radiated a bright white heat. Grass grew only in circles marked off by chains from which were suspended signs forbidding feet. Wrought iron chairs stood about the edge of these pools of dazzling green, and a few people sat in them and stared at the grass as if it were a pond where their faces looked back at them or fish swam. There were not many other customers in the restaurant at that hour. A table of businessmen stabbing fingers at a map and an elegant woman in a grey pantsuit talking animatedly to a poodle seated on a chair opposite. After a time, a group of people converged on the restaurant, talking loudly in foreign accents, punctuated with expansive gestures and bird cries of delight. "Tourists," the acquaintance murmured regretfully. A waiter approached the group and they opened their lips to display huge white smiles. Pink gums showed round the edges of their teeth. The waiter herded them gently but firmly into an arbour where their cries were muted and their bright clothes could not disturb the other diners. An elderly man in a perfectly tailored cream suit and a Panama hat entered and made his way to the next table. He sat down, drawing out a long, slim cigar. The waiter approached and lit it deferentially after snipping off its end. Then, without being asked, a second waiter brought a coffee and a small green glass of liquid on a little tray. The girl watched him pour some of the green liquid into a spoonful of sugar and set a match to it. An emerald flame swelled and hovered above the spoon. When it had burned itself out, the man dribbled the thick, dark residue into his coffee, stirred it, and drank. At length, the aunt pronounced it time to go, refusing the offer of a lift home in the acquaintance's car. They were going by metro, she explained, for the girl must learn to use the subterranean train system in case she wanted to attend the theatre or visit a gallery when her aunt was otherwise occupied. But the metro, the acquaintance said doubtfully. She should never use the metro after dark. I will explain all that needs to be explained in good time, the aunt said in a mildly peevish tone. And then the two women smiled acidly at one another and agreed to take tea together again very soon. You can see it's quite realistic in many ways. And in fact, I saw that man light that cigar. I saw that man use absinthe and light it and saw that green flame. I was sitting in a cafe, in fact, in Prague years later. So Metro Winds was written partly in Prague and partly in Paris. It's the city the story happens in is a hybrid. None of these are real places in the fullest sense of the word. For instance, in The Dove Gang, which is the second story in the collection, the main character is looking for a street which in fact doesn't exist. I don't want anybody to go out there desperately looking for the street in the story. In The Dove Gang, the story's written, and the stories alternate men and women, so mostly. And the story The Dove Gang is set in Paris much more. It's summer again, it's very hot. Both stories happen in summer in this first part of the book. And there's a movement of seasons through the book too. And The Dove Gang came about because I was broke living in Paris. I should explain that the Keesing studio, you're given $9,000 and you're told by the government you have to have a matching amount. And I'd lived on a shoestring my whole life and I thought, I don't need any more, I can live for years on $9,000. So I said, yeah, I've got that. So they gave me the grant, and of course I didn't have any extra money, and I ran out of money really fast, so I was living truly on a shoestring. And I wanted to give my brother a birthday present, and I didn't have any money, so I wrote him a story, which I planned for this. I wrote him a story, postcard by postcard, over the next 2 years, and that story was The Dove Game. The main character in the story is called Daniel, which is the name of my brother, and a lot of things in it remind me very much of him. The character in the story is a young stock rider who witnesses not an accident, but the end of an accident. He finds a man on a roadside where a car's crashed, and the man's dying, and the man asks him to do something for him. And this boy basically goes to Paris. He's never travelled anywhere before. He basically travels to Paris. More than anything that I've written, that really reflects for me my own experience of being that naive Australian young person overseas for the first time, who really didn't have it. I wasn't a sophisticated person, and neither is the boy in the story. And I should also explain that when I was living in Paris, my partner was over there at the same time, and I had to go to Scotland, and he stayed in the studio. And when I came back, he told me this story. He said he'd found this little circus. And I said, what do you mean a little circus? And he said, well, a really little tent with music coming from it, gypsy music, and he's a musician, so he was drawn by the music, and he went inside, and it was like almost like this strange metaphorical circus, because he said, first of all, there was this heart-rendingly beautiful music, and he went inside the tent, paid his money, and sat, like there were about 10 chairs or something facing, and out comes the master of ceremonies with a goat. And he brings this goat out, he's all dressed in a coat, and he brings this goat out with great ceremony, and he opens the mouth of the goat, and he puts his head against the goat's mouth. So it was sort of like a metaphorical lion in some ways. And he told me this incredible story. And I said to him, I love the story so much, I said, give it to me. Give it to me as a present, because he's a writer too, please. And so he gave it to me as a birthday present. So there are two presents connected to that story. And someone told me a story of a circus act in which a woman stood in a crinoline and someone released doves, and each of the doves flew to the dress and landed in the crinoline until it made a dress of doves for her. And I really liked the idea of that. So all of those stories were drawn into the story of the dove game. So that's the second story in the collection. The third story, The Girl Who Could See the Wind. What I was trying to do with The Girl Who Could See the Wind was tell them, this is one of the novellas in the collection, was to tell a fairy tale, but to tell it, to bring it to the modern time, to start somehow in an old world setting and bring it right up to the modern times. And I wanted it to be slightly humorous. I wanted to be there to be a humorous thread through it, and I wanted to tell a story of a winter park. I wanted to tell a story of a park where there was only winter all of the time. I remember years ago, and this is my first editor, was called, her name was Kay Ronay, and she was reading through the first Ovan Newton book, and she said to me, Isabel, you realise there's a lot of winter in this book. There's actually more winter than any other season. And I thought, really? I like winter. Can't we have more? We'll have more winter. In the world after the Holocaust, there is now more winter. That's the beauty of fantasy. You can change the world as you require it. And I love the idea of places that should be only seasons. A season should exist only in a place. So I made a winter park and wrote about a winter park. And it's a story of a quest. It's a romantic story. It's a story about the journey you make to find love. It's not the story of the main character in the fairy tale. It's the story of the sister of the main character in the fairy tale. It's because in a way, while I love fairy tales, there's a rigidity about them. In Green Monkey Dreams, which is coming out again next month, in Green Monkey Dreams is a story called The Pumpkin Eater, in which the girl in the story is a princess waiting for her prince to come along and rescue her. And she lives in a house in a half broken down tower with a mad mother in the top. Doesn't everybody have a mad mother in the top of their tower, in the top of their heads? So there's the mad mother in the story, and the girl in the story is waiting for her prince because she believes that prince will carry her off and they'll travel the world road together. Only the prince doesn't come, he sends his emissary. And as his emissary is bringing her to him, she learns from the emissary what her life as a queen will be once she becomes the queen. And she knows, because this is the way fairy tales work, she knows that when she sees that prince, she must fall in love with him. That rule will not be broken. The minute she sets eyes on him, she will fall in love and her destiny will be connected to him then. And as she learns more and more about what being locked up in a glass castle, she begins to realise why queens might end up mad in the tops of towers when their princes go off as kings to ride off to dragons and never come back. So she begins to realise it won't be anything like she wants. So in the end, she escapes. She creeps away in the night. She gets a little rooster, which is her pet, and she stuffs that rooster down her bosom. Now, that's a lovely thing about fairy tales. You can do really... If I stuff a chicken down my bosom, you would notice. But in fairy tales, people can stick a chicken down their bosom, and that's a perfectly okay thing to do. I should mention that the little bantam rooster is called Courage. So, of course, when she stuffs it down into her chest, she's also taking her own courage. She rides off, and she rides away from the fate that was awaiting her. And in a way, the girl who could see the wind is coming at that from another direction. The story of peripheral characters in a fairy tale. And we learn their story, and we also follow the story of the main character as well. And that was quite a long story again to write. If you would treat that as a novella, as you see, it's quite thick, and some writers would call that a book. So I'm not a writer like that, because these, for me, are not books. Even though they're really quite long, some of them, they're not books. I don't feel they're a book. I do feel they're a short story, but a very long one. The Stranger was, every year, this is going to make you envy me deeply, every second year, I don't mean to strike envy now, but I would envy it too. Every second year I stay on a Greek island called Santorini for a period of time, and I write. And I stay in a village which is right on the top of the island, not down where the beaches and the tourists go, up on the top where I sit on a porch and I look down at the Aegean, which is like silk, and I write. And I have 3 weeks of doing that, and it's heavenly. And when I was there writing one time, I was actually introduced to it. I was taken there for the first time by friends. I was invited there as a guest. I fell in love with it, and I've been going back ever since. The very first time I went there, there was a tatty old travel book with the cover torn off. And I read this line in this tatty old cover book, and the line was, to take vampires to Santorin is to take coals to Newcastle. And I thought, what? Why would vampires come to this sunlit rock with nothing to hide? I mean, it's all rock. There's nothing to hide in. And it's flooded with sunlight. Why on earth would a vampire come there? So I just thought that was weird. But I had in mind that maybe I would use that sometime. And right close to the place where I stay, there's a little church, which at sunset, the sun cuts straight through the doorway of this gorgeous little church. So when you open the door, it shines right in the doorway. It gleams on all of that gold and that ornate stuff. And so it just seemed a strange thing. So all these things went into my head. And a few years later, I wrote this story. And because this was taking a long time and I knew there would be a time, this story came out in a collection. And the editor of that, a couple of these had been published before or while I was putting the whole collection together. And The Stranger I wrote, I sent to the editor, and he wrote back to me and he said, I almost threw my cup of tea in the air, because on the same day that your original story arrived on my desk, another original story from a guy in England arrived on my desk about, well, I shouldn't say what it's about because it's about the same thing in one way, one aspect of the story, well, yes, I will, about a vampire. There's a vampire in the story. I know, I hate saying that. Now I put myself on those shelves with all those other vampire books. It's very peripheral to the story. But this guy had written a story in which he quoted, and I quoted it too in my story, exactly the same line from that out-of-print travel book. And some of the same things, a woman in a white dress and an airport, appear in his story as well. It's quite different than my story, but when I read it, because I was really curious then. So when people talk about morphic resonance, I believe in that now. And if someone could encounter those two stories and say, who copied off who? Except we didn't. And so that's just the story behind that one. So, and that story is a story about, I'll read a little bit of the beginning of this one too. This is a story which is written with a more modern voice. It's about a guy called Case. And that's his second name, but he's called by that. And it's a script writer who can never write an ending, who comes to a very strange but not unsatisfying ending. So this is just the beginning of the story, just to give you a sense of that. What is it about airports? Case thought. There was something almost mythical about the level of boredom and stagnation he felt, trapped in these mazes of shining glass and plastic laid out over acres of bilious-looking carpet. Yet in movies, airports were always represented as glamorous, slightly dangerous places where pursuit scenes erupted violently in the midst of all that coming and going. The protagonist racing along, moving walkways, waving a gun, elbowing extras aside as he pursues the plot. Someday, he'd write a script that captured it all, from the dewy awe you felt at first, primed by all those movies to see airports as portals to worlds of sophistication and mystery, to the disenchantment of the jaded frequent flyer who knew an airport was no more than a tatty waiting room for journeys to the same end. I just wanted to read a little bit to give you a different flavour of a different voice. And you can see in this story that I myself have changed. You can see my progression through the stories too. The first characters, she's also in an airport. Many of the characters travel through airports. And to go from the beginning, when the person's never been in an airport and still finds it enchanting, to this point where this character and me are getting very jaded. We are jaded frequent flyers now, to the end, to the last story in the collection, where the man also is trapped for a while in an airport. That's the man who loses his shadow. And I'll get to that last of all. So that's The Stranger, that story in that collection. The Wolf Prince is the longest story. That's really a novella in the collection. The Wolf Prince is as close to a book as any of the stories get. I'm just going to show you physically the size, so you won't read it impatient for the ending, that you will be patient. As you can see, it could easily be the size of a book. So I'm really wanting people to read it with an open mind for the length of it. It's the length I want it to be. So please don't feel it should be shorter or longer. You can say it's bad, but don't say it's shorter or longer. The Wolf Prince, for me, is written from the age that I am now. It's very much about the princess who fell in love, who married the prince, and he grew into the king, and you still love him, but he's off doing his own thing, and actually he's not quite the centre of things, and while he's wonderful and all the rest of it, he's not quite the centre of your existence anymore. Your children are probably the centre of your existence. And in the story, the woman in the story is at the point where that is almost over, that tentative moment when your child is slipping out of your hands. You want to protect them, you want to look after them, you want to stop them from doing anything dangerous, but they're just about out of range of that. And the woman in the story has a son who is a wolf, and she's trying to save him from a curse, and she has to find a way. And she does. You can help your children, but you can't do it all. And some point comes when you just simply have to let go. And so it's her story, it's a story of her as a queen, but it's also wound with her story as a princess, because once upon a time, she too was the princess in the story. So we go back and forwards in time between the two times. That's partly why it's so long in a way. For me, The Wolf Prince is very much out of the person I am right now in my life, that queen stage of life. When I get to the crone stage, there might be another collection, but I haven't quite reached it yet. That's why the last story in the collection, the man's part of the story in the collection, is written from the point of view of an old man rather than an old woman, because I can imagine that, but I'm not quite ready to imagine. I guess the truth is that I want to be positive about it, and I need to get there to find out what it is that makes that stage of life special and beautiful. I think it must exist, because every stage of life I've ever lived through, once upon a time I looked at people my age and thought, whoa, that's old. And sometimes when I meet grey-haired teachers who are introducing me to to older teenage students, saying, I read you when I was a child, and I realise I am old, but I'm not quite crone stage yet, because I'm not reached the stage where I think that I'm imagining that you would let go of some things at that point, and I'm not ready to let go of anything just yet. So the last story in it, I think that's why the last story is slightly humorous, and I'd like to read you a little bit of this one too. It's a story about a man who discovers he's lost his shadow, and he goes to somewhat of the story is in Prague, but I'd like to read you a particular bit where he decides to hire a detective to find his shadow. But forgive me, I should have put a piece of paper in this before I started. It's really taking a long time. So he goes to, I did not know what it meant to lose my shadow. I have to use a particular voice. I have a very strong voice when I read, and if I read some of those stories, I'm avoiding reading so I don't have to put the voice on. But I have to do it with this story. I did not know what it meant to lose my shadow. After my initial blank disbelief upon discovering it, I sought help. Ironically, I went to a doctor first, a general practitioner more accustomed to removing warts and administering antibiotics and tranquilizers than to treating a man with an ailment as rare and arcane as mine. She offered me a carmative, and seeing her disdain, I told her somewhat haughtily that she need not suppose that anything was wrong with my mind. Could she not accept the evidence of her eyes that I had done? I lacked a shadow. What could be more empirical, more concrete? Yet she simply pretended to be confused by my symptoms. "What exactly do you want?" she demanded finally. I asked her coldly to refer me to a specialist in shadows, since her own training seemed to have left her ill-equipped for such exotic conditions. Somewhat maliciously, I suspect, she sent me to a radiologist whose view of shadows was shaped entirely by his daily quest for shadows that signified cancers and tumours on his X-rays. I can only say his mind had been seriously warped by his profession. When I told him of my problem, his eyes blazed and he clutched my arm hard enough to leave a bruise, proclaiming that I was the first human to have escaped the curse of shadows. He confided his belief that they were not bestowed by God, as was generally supposed, but had been visited upon us by some force which he refused to name. His mania was apparent when I questioned him about the purpose of shadows. He gave me an affronted look and asked what sort of man I thought he was, to ask him such a question, exactly as if I had asked the shade of his pubic hair. He had insisted on taking and developing an X-ray plate, which he examined suspiciously, finally announcing in a slightly resentful tone that he saw no shadow. After that, I gave up on the medical profession. I was not really ill, I reasoned. Having lost a shadow, I was more like a man whose wife leaves him, clearing out their apartment with mysterious speed and efficiency. With this in mind, I consulted a private investigating firm. The man who ran the agency gave his name as Andrews, which might as well be his surname as his first name. "I've never been asked to shadow a shadow before," he said, when I laid the matter before him. I can only suppose he meant it as a joke, but I did not laugh. I am not good at humour. I told him this. He squinted at me, seeming suddenly sobered. "Perhaps that's the whole point," he said. "Your lack of humour. Think of it from the point of view of a shadow, having to endure being dragged about, never having a chance to exert its own mind or will or taste, and on top of that, to be forced to live with someone who has no sense of humour. It must be unendurable." He seemed very sincere, but a certain reticence in my own character prevented me breaking down and confessing my fear of precisely this eventuality, that some profound lack in me had driven away my shadow. So, the stories, there's six of them. Is there six? I always forget how many there are. Numbers, and I'm not good with numbers.
One, two, three.
Yes, six stories. So those six stories come very much out of that period of time I've been overseas. In fact, it works perfectly for me because next year I'll be coming back to live. So I'm hoping I rediscover Australia with fresh eyes as well. So that's pretty much all I wanted to say about this collection. I know, and we're going to open up from some questions, and Erica's also going to take part in this in case you want to ask her any secrets about me. She will be answering, although I will be here beside her, so she won't be able to be too scurrilous. So maybe, would anybody like to ask some questions?
How old were you when you first went
to Paris? I think I was in my late 20s, early 30s. Late to travel overseas. I'd always thought I'd travel early, but yeah, quite late. And I never thought I would travel anywhere. I thought when you become a writer, you have to be poor and you have to be having no children and have no husband because they might cost money, the kid and the husband. And the house, I thought I'd never have a house, and I only ever bought furniture that I could lift myself. I really wanted to be independent. I didn't have a car, and then I had bombs so bad that when I drove around the corner, the doors would fly open. And so that was that period of life, and I, at 19 or 20, sort of just abdicated all possibility of travel, thinking, well, I'll just be this writer, and that was okay. And you can do that at 19 or 20. But then I did travel. Writing bought me absolutely everything in the end. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, I just wanted to remind people that Green Monkey...